WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When a CIA spy needed to slip in or out of a country unnoticed, they often required the help of Antonio Mendez. As the CIA's master of disguise, Mendez helped create new identities, new faces, and new papers for spies. He retired in 1990 after 25 years with the CIA. In 1997, as part of the agency's 50th anniversary celebration, he received a CIA Trailblazer Award, recognizing him as one of 50 officers who helped shape the agency's first 50 years. Now he's written a memoir called The Master of Disguise, My Secret Life with the CIA. Let's start with an example of his work during the Cold War. In 1972, he was in Laos in Southeast Asia. He had to arrange a way for an African-American CIA case officer to meet with and get information from a government official without them being recognized.
This black officer was obviously well-known in town, suspected to be CIA, and rather obvious in a small fishbowl kind of situation. The Asian cabinet-level fellow was a national figure. So that was sort of the essence of an espionage problem. That is, to meet securely and not draw attention. So this black officer said, "I got a problem," because the curfew has been put in force and there are civil roadblocks being thrown up without notice, and I really have a problem meeting this guy on the day of the cabinet meeting and debriefing him. Typically, what they would do is execute a car pickup. In other words, on a back street after dark, the case officer would pause briefly, and the asset, as we would call him, would jump into the car. But in fact, if they ran into a roadblock, they would be up against it. So I planned to go to the meeting that they had scheduled that night and figure out how to work this problem. And then the next day I wrote a long dispatch back to headquarters saying, this is the way I would approach it. Why don't you call that fellow in Hollywood that you recently contacted and see if he has any ideas? Well, he did. He went out to his shed in the backyard and measured some moles and came up with two stunt double disguises and sent them off. I had the blank faces of Victor Mature and Rex Harrison.
So the masks looked like Victor Mature and Rex Harrison. Were the people at the checkpoints not hip to who Victor Mature and Rex Harrison were?
Well, in fact, once we dressed them up, they didn't look like exactly like those two fellows, but it was rather humorous to think that, in fact, we were borrowing the features of two well-known motion picture stars. And anyway, the rest of the package was the Chevrolet sedan with the corps diplomatique plates on it, the appropriate credentials, the fact that we had now two Caucasians in a car that was plainly marked as an American official car. Was really the cover. That was the window dressing, if you will.
Now, when you give somebody a disguise, do you have to teach them how to behave like somebody else in addition to how to look like somebody else?
Yeah, most people think that the facial oval is where the disguise takes place. But in fact, what you're doing is managing a stage. You're dressing the stage. It's like writing a screenplay or a play. So you may set up the deception 6 months ahead of time, and the actual use of the disguise is just incidental to all the things that have gone before. You give those who are trying to keep track of you handles that they can latch onto, like the color of your coat or the size of your dog or your spouse, your car. All those things are part of a disguise. And, of course, your mannerisms. The way you act when you come out the door every morning would be a signal that's you. Just a nonverbal, like a habit of looking right and left before you step down from the door.
I want you to tell the story of the six American diplomats who were in Tehran during the Iranian hostage crisis and had to get out of Iran. They were, I think, taking refuge in the Canadian embassy, and it was your job to get them disguises so that they could sneak out of Iran and return safely to the United States. You came up with a really elaborate, very interesting and surprising cover story. What was the cover story you came up with?
Again, the Hollywood connection. When you have a situation like that, which we call an exfiltration, you're always worrying about the legend, the reason for somebody to be there that would be innocuous. But in this case, six people who were non-operatives, you know, they were just innocent Americans who got caught in Tehran at the time of the embassy was overrun. We couldn't come up with a plausible reason for six plus two, which would be me and my partner, to be ostensibly in country at that point.
You couldn't very well say they were diplomats, because then they wouldn't have let them out.
Right. We couldn't say they were Americans either, although there was some consideration for that. There was one story that was offered up to call them six out of work American school teachers, which seemed rather thin. But usually when you come up with a cover, a legend for an operative, you come up with something very boring and sort of nondescript, and the professional can sort of flesh it out as he goes along. But in this case, everybody was worried how these people would fare, and so I came up with something really outrageous, because no one would expect that these people would be anything else but what we decided, and that was to make them into a pre-production location scouting party from Hollywood, looking for a place to shoot about 10 days of their movie.
And so in order to make this cover work, you had to come up with a lot of things. A film script, a logo for the film company. You even took out ads in the trade magazines like Variety, announcing that you were about to begin shooting this new movie.
Good example of a deception being set up ahead of time. But we also occupied offices on the old Columbia studio lot in Hollywood. In fact, Michael Douglas had just vacated those rooms, having just finished China Syndrome. And we were lucky to be able to call in some favors. Actually, my makeup consultant was able to call in favors and get those rooms, and we were able to set up this production company over the weekend.
Now, did the people at Columbia know? This was on the Columbia lot, right?
Yeah, the old one.
Did they know what you were up to, or did they think that you were really filming this movie?
Well, everybody thought we were filming this movie. In fact, people were coming out of the woodwork trying to get jobs and
trying to get parts
and bringing us scripts. We had some really interesting projects offered by the time that we got done with the operation. We could have kept going.
So what were the disguises that you smuggled in to Iran? And the diplomats, the American diplomats who you had to take out of the country were taking refuge at the Canadian embassy. So how did you get yourself and the disguises into the Canadian embassy without being noticed?
This wasn't really an elaborate disguise problem. This was just a matter of restyling people that were not subject to hostile pursuit. But we made this a high priority during that particular period, because we realized that at least one member of the media, if not three, had figured out where they were. And so it was a matter of time before the Canadian embassy was overrun. So the idea was that we had to get in before hostile pursuit, in which case they were not being sought. So it was a matter of creating this grand stage in which they could, you know, just be restyled and play their parts.
So they could look like Hollywood people and not diplomats.
Yeah, in other words, we just changed their hairstyle and some of their habits and made them
look a little more L.A.?
A little more L.A., yeah.
So what did you do exactly? Give us an example.
Well, one of the things that I had along with me was a portfolio with which I could have sold the Ministry of National Guidance of Iran the whole idea of the movie, because it was so full of window dressing and and good ideas about the movie, you know, as well as the dossier on each one of these people, which was a very clever way of disguising their legend. And so each one of them got a copy of the dossier when I got in there, and they were able to study it for a couple, 3 days and sort of fall into the role. We obviously had all, not only the passports that the Canadians gave us for them, but we had all the trade cards and other kinds of pocket litter, as we would call it, you know, to go along with.
What is pocket litter?
Well, if you start going through your purse or your pockets, you will find that you have coins or bus coupons or matches from the Brown Derby in Hollywood. You know, the kind of thing that would be sort of look rather casual, but adds, you know, to the whole picture, kind of gives it more realism.
My guest is Antonio Mendez, the CIA's former master of disguise. He's written a new memoir. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Antonio Mendez, the CIA's former master of disguise. When we left off, he was telling us how he got 6 American diplomats out of Iran during the hostage crisis by disguising them as filmmakers scouting a location. Until recently, you weren't able to tell the actual story of how you came up with the disguises and the Hollywood cover for these 6 American diplomats, because that was classified until, I don't know, a couple of years ago, maybe, was it?
Yeah, and on the 50th anniversary of the CIA, they decided they wanted to celebrate for the first time in 50 years, and so they asked if they could tell the story. But until that point, for 17 years, it had been everybody's version that it was the Canadian ambassador that had done all this. And of course, he went on to fortune and fame as a result.
How do you feel when a mission of yours has to remain secret and you don't get to take any credit for it outside of the CIA?
But you don't take credit in that business. In fact, what's happening now, including with my memoir, is a violation of the code of the spy. And that code is you don't celebrate your successes or explain your failures. And now we have a kind of a new corporate change and an outlook, and we're trying to do a little work on image. It's called openness, and it seems to be working out. But I was quite happy to take this story to my grave and kind of feeling that this is a really good piece of cover and security. You know, there's a kind of an inverse feeling of power of being in the know when no one else is.
How did you learn to not let nervousness betray you when you were on a mission? And that's a skill I imagine you also had to teach some of the people who you worked with when you were giving them their disguises.
Well, I'm not sure how I learned it, but in fact, it's obviously very important. Demeanor is really more important. The subjective quality of the individual in their documents and their legend is more important than the literal quality of them. So you know, you have to be a natural actor, and when you're faced with somebody that you're trying to help in the middle of the night, which is typical, you know, they basically, a defector is like a man on a ledge. They've made a very important mental decision before they come to you. It's very hard to get them to go back, but it's also very difficult to get inside their head and make them feel that they can do something rather strange, something they've never done before, and do it in just in a matter of minutes or hours and get away with it. So the demeanor that I have to project is not only the sense of confidence on my part, but project it into them and just tell them to have a little courage. And usually I'm there, or one of us is there with them to lead them through, and you say, just do what I do. And so it's all part of falling into a groove, falling into the part, and carrying through.
You had worked as an illustrator, I think, for an aviation company before joining the CIA. What's the best training that you had for this job before you took the job?
Well, I was an artist of some sort all my life. So, and I was interested in magic and in the theatrical arts and so forth. So that, you know, I was sort of naturally inclined to do this work. But some of the best training I had was probably as a teenager on the streets of Denver. You know, the street smarts are probably just as important than, you know, creative arts.
I don't think of the CIA as being a particularly artsy kind of crowd. Did you feel like a fish out of water at any point?
Not at all. Everybody that's there is a romantic, for starters, and they have an adventuresome spirit. And every day we knew we were doing God's work, so there was no higher calling that we could think of. And the fact that we were considered to be the gang that couldn't shoot straight was just an advantage. That just gave us a little more of an edge. The fact that we were considered to be thugs, again, you know, tended to make people look for the thugs instead of the people who were really creative. It was truly a creative kind of pursuit and great fun.
Were there ever times during your years with the CIA that you strongly disapproved of a mission, but either had to work on it anyways or had to watch your colleagues work on it?
Well, I never got in a situation where I felt I was doing something that was immoral, or certainly it was all illegal, because that's what espionage is about, is breaking the laws of another country and stealing their secrets and doing it every week. But I never felt that it was something that we shouldn't be doing from a moral point of view. There were times when we mounted operations that were not as good as they could be, but we kind of jokingly said, well, you know, 90% of operations are really for practice. It's the 10% that count.
But did you ever feel like during Iran-Contra, or at times when, you know, the CIA was, say, you know, working with a dictator in Latin America, where you felt like this isn't really exactly what I'd like to be doing?
Well, you know, there's a lot of hindsight involved in some of that. But Iran-Contra, for instance, is an example of where the administration in the White House wasn't getting everything it wanted from the CIA. So it kind of went into business for themselves, if you will. And every time that happened, in my experience, they got in trouble because they weren't professionals. We were and still are, the CIA is probably one of the highest regulated, the most tightly controlled from an oversight point of view of any. And that, a lot of that came out of the Watergate era and the Senate investigations and so forth. But I say bring on the oversight. That's great. There were ideas that the administration had that they brought to us that we sort of drug our feet on because we'd been there before, that these things don't work kind of attitude. Not that they were against the law, or I should say U.S. law, or outside of, what you consider to be good moral bounds. But there were a lot of times when they were just stupid ideas.
Mm-hmm. Your wife is also a former chief of disguise for the CIA. I don't think there's a lot of married couples who've both been the chief of disguise for the CIA. Did you meet at the CIA?
Yeah, actually, we got married after I left in 1990. We were both working in various places in the CIA, but we'd first met about the mid-70s and ended up where she was my subordinate as the chief of disguise. I'd already said to her that, you know, we can't be in the same line of command here. One of us is going to have to move. It might as well be me. And then all of a sudden, Congress opened the window for 30 days and said, if you got the age, you can, and all the other requirements, you can take everything you've contributed to your annuity out and still keep your annuity. So that was hard to pass up given the personal situation.
Well, Antonio Mendez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Antonio Mendez has written a new memoir called The Master of Disguise, My Secret Life with the CIA. This is Fresh Air.